I'm Phil Picardi, and this is the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Today on the podcast, the GOP gets surprising help in its effort to turn back a new state sales tax. Jim Abler believes he's an able Senate candidate. Some crops actually need the heat, and some species go on and some come off the lists of endangered species in the state. First, some business news. Richfield-based Best Buy is reporting a sharp increase in second quarter net income. The electronics retailer says it earned $266 million for the period that ended earlier this month. For the same quarter last year, Best Buy earned only $12 million. Best Buy has cut costs and revamped stores to offset competition. Brian Yarbrough is an analyst with Edward Jones.
The profitability came in better in the earnings number due to less margin pressure from lowering prices. They are offsetting it with efficiencies in the supply chain and cost saves, and that's really what's driving the overall profitability.
Best Buy says it plans to further reduce prices to increase its competitiveness with rivals like Walmart and Amazon.com. Minnesota Orchestra Management has confirmed Swedish recording company BIS has postponed a planned September session, saying the orchestra is not ready because of an ongoing lockout. Here's Ewan Kerr.
The Minnesota Orchestra was due to record the Sibelius 3rd and 6th Symphonies in September under the baton of music director Osmo Venska. The orchestra's recording of the Sibelius 2nd and 5th Symphonies, which BIS released in early 2012, received a Grammy nomination. However, BIS officials say they are withdrawing from the September sessions because they no longer believe the orchestra is in good enough shape to meet the exacting standards the label requires, even if there is a quick resolution to the dispute and rehearsals resume. Orchestra officials say they agree that a recording session should not be the first project for the orchestra, even if there is an agreement in time. They say they hope to reschedule the recording for the spring. Ewan Kerr, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A new recommendation for Medicare funding could mean cuts to rural hospitals across the U.S. The funding supports so-called critical access hospitals that provide care in relatively remote areas. Some experts question whether extra funding for these facilities is a good use of health care dollars. Terry Hill is with the National Rural Health Resource Center in Duluth. He says cutting the program would be a mistake.
It would have a pretty catastrophic impact upon the economies of our local communities, our rural communities in general. And we're not quite sure for what purpose. The authors of the study have alleged that there are savings to be achieved. Our numbers suggest to the contrary, that there really isn't any savings.
Minnesota could be particularly vulnerable to cuts to critical access hospital funding. Most rural hospitals in the state would not meet a proposed higher threshold for rural hospital funding. Minnesota's list of endangered and threatened species has been updated. Off the list, bald eagles, snapping turtles, and gray wolves. But the DNR is adding 180 other species. The DNR's Rich Baker talked about it with Tom Cran last night.
So first, we should say this is different than the federal endangered species list, correct?
Good point, yes.
And it's specifically for Minnesota animals and plants. You've added 180 new species to it. Only 26 have been removed. So on the surface, that sounds like an alarming trend, is it?
The trend is actually as much about the new information that we have as it is about the state of our environment in Minnesota. We have spent the last couple of decades gathering an enormous amount of new information about where plants and animals are in the state, and we've looked carefully at that information to decide which species we know enough about to be able to say, well, this one is indeed rare, and this one we just are not sure about.
So when you look at all the species that have been added to the list, whose statuses have worsened from special concern to threatened or even endangered, right? That's the sort of worst category, if we
right.
will. What story do you get about where Minnesota's environment is most threatened?
Well, we have some classically rare habitats in Minnesota. Minnesota's native prairie, we have less than 1% of what was originally prairie. Most of it's agricultural land now. There's, in the southeastern part of the state, there's a kind of habitat called savanna, which used to be much more widely distributed in the state. It's now very rare. In both those cases, we have lots of species that were tied very closely to those habitats. And as those habitats decline, those species decline. A great example, Tom, is our two species of butterfly, prairie butterflies, Dakota and Poshik skippers. These are two prairie species that we have elevated from special concern status to endangered status with this change because of the loss of habitat.
Now, we have heard a lot about the success of the bald eagle in recent years, but what other success stories are in this new update?
Two species of bird, peregrine falcon and trumpeter swan, are both species that have been on the threatened list for many years, and we're now moving to special concern status. The purpose of the endangered species list is not to just call them endangered and leave them there. It's kind of like an emergency room. We want to do what we can to get them out of there as quickly as possible.
Get them off the list.
And so in the case of peregrine falcon and trumpeter swan, we've put a lot of effort into recovering those species.
Is there a species on the list, as you look at it, with an especially interesting story?
Oh, there's lots. You know, one that is intriguing that jumps to mind is we've all heard about how moose are declining in the state and there will be no moose hunt this year. Well, there's a moss that grows on moose dung, only on moose dung, that we are now listing as an endangered species. Well, isn't that an interesting story? Here, moose are declining, and here's a species that relies on moose in order to exist. With one, so goes the other. So there's an intriguing story for you.
Skeptics listening might say that extinction is inevitable in certain species, and so why does this matter in a larger context, not specifically about each species?
Well, endangered and threatened species, you know, it's a cliche, but they really are the canaries in the coal mine. And we don't know at what point losing species are going to cause the machinery of the natural systems to start falling apart and not operating the way they should. So I believe, and we at the DNR believe that, and the law requires that we do what we can to retain all of the species native in the state. We don't know what the results of not doing that would be, so it is wise to do it.
Rich Baker is Endangered Species Coordinator at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. We've been talking about the first major update to Minnesota's list of threatened and endangered species in 16 years. Thanks for coming in and speaking with us about it. I appreciate it.
Thanks again, Tom.
Rich Baker and Tom Cran. Republican state lawmakers have gained a surprising ally in their push to use a potential special session on disaster relief next month to repeal some recent tax law changes. Former DFL Speaker of the House Margaret Anderson Kelleher, who is now one of the state's leading broadband advocates, has joined the GOP call for the elimination of a new sales tax on telecommunication equipment purchases, which is one of the three taxes on the Republican repeal list. Here's our state capitol reporter, Tim Pugmire.
As chair of the governor's broadband task force, Kelleher wrote a letter to her boss last week highlighting concerns about a new law that makes capital equipment purchases by telecommunications companies subject to the state sales tax. It impacts big companies like CenturyLink and Comcast and dozens of smaller entities throughout the state. Kelleher, who is also the director of the Minnesota High Tech Association, told DFL Governor Mark Dayton that the new tax will result in less spending on new infrastructure and fewer jobs related to those projects. She said the estimated $75 million in taxes collected over the next 2 years will mean an equal amount not spent on things needed to improve internet and cell phone service in rural areas.
Certainly with aggressive goals in the state of having border-to-border broadband by 2015, which right now we're not on track to meet, we're getting closer all the time, this doesn't help speed our way to get there.
Kelleher said lawmakers eliminated a sales tax exemption that task force members wanted expanded to cover more types of telecommunications equipment, such as fiber optic cable. She said they want lawmakers to restore the exemption in a special session or as soon as possible.
They see it as something that Democrats and Republicans both should be behind. This, I think, is a case where being able to correct this and take it back and make it the way it had been for about a decade or more makes a lot of sense.
But for now, Kelleher's recommendation matches Republicans, not Democrats. Governor Dayton wants to call a special session on September 9th to provide disaster relief to 18 counties hit hard by June storms. He also wants to approve a farm machinery exemption to a new tax on business equipment repairs. DFL House Speaker Paul Thiessen and DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach agreed to that two-item agenda, and they say there's enough money available to offset the $28 million needed for the farm exemption. But Bach said that's the only tax he's willing to revisit.
Beyond that, things get awful expensive. The farm piece is a very small piece that we thought there would be some bipartisan agreement for, so we'll see. But anything beyond that, you start probably dipping into the budget reserve to pay for things, and that I don't support. We finally got the state's budget structural problems fixed, and I'm not interested in going into the budget reserve to provide tax relief for people. It's not what it's for.
But Republicans are holding out for more. In addition to the telecommunications tax, they want to repeal the entire tax on business equipment repairs, as well as a new tax on warehousing services. All three repeals would put an estimated $314 million hole in the current two-year budget. GOP Senate Minority Leader David Hahn said last week that he has some ideas for plugging that hole, but he declined to offer specifics.
What we suggested is that if we commit to trying to find a way, then we can have a full discussion about that. But there are ways to do it, and we've got a $38 billion budget, whatever it is, $300 million or some lesser piece of that. We could find that if we want to do that.
House and Senate leaders are expected to meet with the governor again Wednesday to try to agree on a special session agenda. They're also looking at whether they can avoid a special session by redirecting unused state aid that was allocated for previous disasters.
Tim Pugmire on the NPR News Update. This morning, Kathy Werzer talked politics on Morning Edition. She interviewed another candidate for Senate.
U.S. Senator Al Franken is up for re-election in November of 2014, and already there are three Republicans stepping up to run against him. We're going to talk to each of them in the coming days. We're going to start with State Representative Jim Abler of Anoka, who is in studio. Good to see you.
Yeah, good morning.
You're a chiropractor by trade. You spent your 15 years in the State House as a respected expert on health and human services programs in Minnesota. Is health care where you want to focus your energies, your attention, if you get to the U.S. Senate?
Well, it's certainly my area of strength, and it's an area that a lot of people are not strong in, and I think our party as a national group is weak in it, and that's what draws me to this race.
Would you want to see Obamacare repealed?
Well, in the beginning, they should have actually been more cooperative in passing it. Anytime you pass something with all the votes on one side and none on the other side, it's going to be controversial, and there's so many gaps in it. You know, can it be fixed? I don't know, maybe, but it's a mess, and I think that's going to be unfolding. And so if you could do a do-over with, like, you know, 10 of each side working together, you could get a much better product.
Well, as you know, some of the criticisms of the GOP is they don't have another plan. So what would your plan be to fix this?
Well, you want to build on the strengths of our system. The strengths of our system, we have a lot of really good doctors. We would build on what we did in Minnesota. You'd have cooperative efforts toward prevention. Minnesota's a leader, by the way. If you exported Minnesota to Washington and just put it there, you could be done. Minnesota, there is no healthcare crisis. In Mississippi, probably so. But then when you do a one-size-fits-all national plan, it just messes it all up. There's doctors who are really good doctors who talk about quitting. Quitting. But there is no quality improvements. There's no cost containment. The Obamacare thing is all about access. Sign more people up, get them in the door into an unmanaged system that actually is going to provoke some of the more cost and quality issues that Minnesota has tackled.
I was on your website, and you talked about your new granddaughter, Raina. She was born New Year's Day, is that right?
That's right. How exciting.
Got a picture of her right there in front of you.
Yeah.
And on the website, you say your granddaughter, Raina, will have to pay for a system of programs that have made a lot of people dependent on the government. When we are dependent on the government, you write, we are absolutely not free. Now, programs that folks depend on, Medicare, Social Security, are pretty popular, as you know. And a lot of people say, hey, I worked hard. I pay my taxes. I paid into the system. I want something out of it. So with that statement on your website, are you saying that a whole lot of Americans, including a big chunk of your constituents, are dependent on government and that shouldn't be the case?
It's okay to help people who need some help. Minnesota is a generous state. Where I grew up, we're happy to help our neighbor. But when people become dependent upon that, then they are insecure, actually. And there's actually a glass ceiling that stops people who have a lot of state and federal programs from actually going beyond that. We don't have a very good system of moving people from temporary help into weaning them into being independent.
But what about folks like, say, your mom? I bet she gets Medicare. I bet she gets Social Security.
Oh, well, sure. Those are people paid into those. I'm not talking about changing any of that. I'm talking about what people think of as a welfare system and a subsidized health care system. When we borrow money to help people subsidize programs that actually make them more dependent, we actually are going to change our own future and cause the system to become bankrupt.
Medicare, Medicaid make up about 21% of the federal budget, I believe. Social Security is about 22%. Do you have to look at those programs as government programs and try to reform them? What would you do in order to kind of keep them solvent?
Medicare is not going to be sustainable with the revenue coming in and the demands going out. But if you look at some of the stuff Medicare pays for, it's not a good product. The fanciest wheelchair, the fanciest whatever, it's all free. None of it's free. And so when you help people realize that what they're getting just doesn't come out of thin air, then they begin to appreciate the value of it. But what happens politically is you do one thing to change Medicare, and the other side of the aisle says, oh, look, you're gutting Medicare, and people will die in the street. Probably not true anyway, but it doesn't help solve the problem. And that's why people like me need to be in Washington, because we can say, stop. What is the problem? Let's focus on the problem. And part of why I'm concerned about Mr. Franken is I think he's kind of bored by his job. I don't think his gift set and skill set matches what America needs.
And you seem to be able to work with both sides of the aisle. You've worked with DFLers.
Right.
Most notably, you helped to override Governor Plenty's veto of the higher gas tax in 08. You were slapped down for that, and as you know. 2010, you got the endorsement of the State Teachers Union, which is a little unusual for a Republican lawmaker. You supported Ron Paul for president last year. So you're kind of, you know, you're a bit of a maverick, I guess. Where do you fit in the Republican Party?
I think right smack in the middle. I think that you know, Republican principles, personal responsibility, a government that works but doesn't overreach. We have to have some government. There's no way to have it go away. And Republicans know that. Republicans are generous. They're charitable. They help their neighbor. And they want it to work. They like their privacy, and they want to achieve the American dream, which is to the quiet enjoyment of their life in this wonderful country. And they want to know they can just go to, they can do their job, they can send their kid to college if they want to go, they can have a pickup or a Prius, and they quietly want to do America. And based upon that, a lot of people would fit the Republican model. And so I'm smack in the middle of that.
Representative, thanks for the conversation.
Thanks for having me.
That's Jim Abler and Kathy Werzer. Well, the heat is on across the region, but Minnesota crops are still behind schedule, and that's starting to worry some farmers. Our Mark Stile says any frost in September would be more damaging than usual to a crop that's still developing.
There's a lot of money growing in Minnesota farm fields. Last year's corn and soybean crops were worth almost $14 billion. Crops around the state have struggled this year all summer to catch up after a so-called spring that saw a big dump of snow in May. A streak of rainy weather also delayed planting. By June, it looked like the worst was past and the state's second-largest corn crop ever was advancing. But a run of cool weather in July and early August also hurt development. Chad Willis says on his farm near Wilmer in central Minnesota, the corn crop needs another 6 weeks or more to reach maturity.
I would think early to mid-October probably.
The latest Minnesota crop progress report shows most of the state is behind schedule. Only 27% of the corn crop has reached the stage where the kernels are filling with nutrients. Normally, it's 47% by now. For Chad Willis, that means frost is a concern. If cold weather holds off until the median first frost date, around October 3rd, his crops may be all right. But an unusually early freeze, say mid-September, would cut his corn harvest significantly, maybe 7% or more. The warmer weather forecast for the next week, including some 90-degree temperatures, should speed crop maturity and lessen the extent of damage from an early frost. But Willis says that the heat is not totally beneficial. He says that's because it will dry things out even faster.
We could use a shot. shot of rain, too. This is a critical time for moisture for the soybeans and also the corn.
Although it's nothing like last year's drought, dry conditions are taking hold again in parts of Minnesota. The latest drought monitor map shows abnormally dry conditions stretching across southwest and central parts of the state. Northwest Minnesota also needs rain. And it's not just Minnesota. Dry conditions are increasing across much of the Midwestern Corn Belt, including Nebraska, Iowa, and Illinois. Scott Strand with North Star Commodity in Minneapolis says the moisture deficit is pushing up crop prices because traders are worried it will reduce the number of bushels harvested this fall.
With the lack of moisture, you could see some yield reduction loss based on that dryness out there. You still need some kind of rain to continue the development of the plant.
Both corn and soybean prices moved sharply higher today because of dry weather concerns. Corn was up more than 20 cents a bushel, or about 4%. But the warm, dry weather may be more of a concern for areas to the south of Minnesota. Here, it may do more good than harm. That's because every nice day reduces the risk of significant crop damage should the state experience an early freeze. University of Minnesota agronomist Jeff Coulter says right now the corn crop is 7 to 10 days behind schedule. He says above normal weather into September, though, would make up some of that delay.
I would say that if the temperatures remain warm, the crop could catch back up within a few days of where it should be.
At only a few days behind, much more of the crop would be safe from damage should freezing temperatures come early. But lack of moisture remains a threat. Coulter says right now it's probably hurting soybeans more than corn. But both crops need late-season rains to reach their full potential.
Mark Stile down on the farm. A new federal estimate suggests Lyme disease cases may be vastly underreported. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the tick-borne disease likely affects around 300,000 Americans annually. That's 10 times higher than the number of documented cases. Minnesota reports between 1,000 and 1,300 cases of Lyme disease each year. Department of Health epidemiologist Dave Neitzel says the true number of Lyme cases in the state is probably higher than that, but he doubts the figure is 10 times higher because he says Minnesota has a good surveillance system that requires doctors to report each instance of the disease.
Sometimes doctors can diagnose a case of Lyme disease just based on the presence of a Lyme disease rash without doing testing of that patient. And, some of those cases where testing is not done, those are the ones that we may not hear about.
The CDC's Lyme disease estimates come from surveys of national laboratories and patients and a review of insurance records. Minneapolis officials want pet owners to get their animals licensed. The city's Animal Care and Control Office takes in nearly 4,000 animals a year. Officials say last year more than 90% of the pets were either returned to their owners, adopted, or sent to other rescue groups. City Council member and dog owner Lisa Goodman says the city's shelter has made it easier to reunite lost pets with their owners with a revamped website. However, she says pet licenses also make it easier for animal control agents to contact owners of lost animals.
If you license your dog, we can make that connection much more quickly between your lost dog and you, because you'll have a license, we'll have a record of your dog, we can call you, and we can even give your dog a free ride home.
The city of Minneapolis requires licenses for pet dogs, cats, ferrets, and rabbits. I'm Phil Picardi, hippity-hoppity, down the road with another NPR News update. See you here again tomorrow.